Mr. Fiddler, Reel 5. We're talking about your time with the 2nd Fife and Fofar A Squadron at Rudston and Bridlington. And we were talking about the characteristics of a Sherman tank. What I'd like to look at is exactly what your job was as co-driver.
Okay, now, firstly, a job that I didn't like at all. It was a job where there was very, very, very little to do. It was just alongside the driver. Very occasionally you might get the chance of going into the driver's seat, but very, 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 very little. You had a machine gun. It was a
Browning
machine gun, and I can't remember the rate of fire. But as I say, the job in the coal driver's department was very, very little. He helped when we were on schemes or even in action. There was always tea to be made, there was always brewing up. But this was mainly done in the turret, but when outside of the tank, the co-driver would put in his two-penner. So the co-driver side of it was very, very limited and not a likeable job.
And what about your perspective from the co-driver seat? What could you see?
Well, if you were driving up, that's a totally different thing. But driving with periscopes was limited to a degree. Although you had, I think you had 380 degrees revolving with a periscope revolving. So you could, you had to see on your left or your right. You had to move the periscope accordingly. So the view, but this also went for the driver. He had the same view as what the co-driver did. He was well up. He wasn't sit down at all. He had an all-round vision, providing the periscope was moved.
And what about the? Did you have a duplicate set of controls, or
The co-driver had no control of the tank whatsoever. None.
So if you were going to become driver, you had to change seats.
You had to get out and change seats. You couldn't change seats. It was difficult to change seats. Somebody had to get out to allow you to get over the transmission.
Now, what about the operation of the Browning? What about that?
As far as I know, this obviously was a belt-fed gun. It did have its stoppages, the occasional stoppage. This was, if I remember rightly, this was a you had to pull back the bolt to cock it, and then away it went. To get the gun into where the machine gun sat, you had to bring it up through the co-driver's compartment to get it in and out. It was belt fed from ammunition boxes in the co-driver's department.
So anything else about being a co-driver?
Really nothing.
And you didn't,
except for the cleaning of the gun, but that was done with the gunner and the co-driver cleaned the guns, and they did get the occasional stoppage, but we knew how to get rid of these, how to get rid of the stoppage, which I can't remember now.
Now, there was a series of exercises and training exercises with the new Shermans, of which the two best, the most noted in the history, Black Cock and Eagle. Do you remember anything about either of those exercises?
I do remember a lot about Exercise Eagle. We were out for approximately 2 weeks, and we were on half rations. In other words, it was really a hardening up procedure. And also partially, we were never told, but also partially to live off the land. But I would like to say there was one instance that happened to me. We were doing a troop exercise, which meant that we were all line abreast going up this hill. I was driving the tank without, on this particular day, without a co-driver. and this proved to be very, very lucky indeed. We were treading up this field that was quite an incline. I missed a gear. I panicked. We started rolling back very fast. I let me clutch out, and the prop shaft tore away from the gearbox, from the transmission, tore the co-driver's seat, the holding down bolts from the hull of the tank, and just wrecked the seat completely. If there had been a co-driver in there on that particular day, he would have been very, very mashed up. So that meant that the prop shaft comes from the engine, which is at the back, to the transmission, which is at the front of the tank, goes underneath the turret and comes out between the two drivers. There was a cowling over the top of the prop shaft. This was tore away. The universal coupling from the gearbox to the prop shaft, all the bolts were torn. And still going round, just leapt across to the co-driver compartment, ripped the seat out, and that was it, finished for the day. I then had to go back with the tank and a recovery vehicle to brigade workshops, where I spent 7 days until the tank was complete, and then back to the squadron.
Would you get into trouble for something like that?
Well, we did get into trouble on a certain thing, but in this case, I never heard a thing about it, which is very unusual.
Now, what about any key characters? You were in A Squadron, and which troop were you in?
I can't remember what troop I was in. The amazing thing is, I can only remember the troop that I went across on D-Day, which had come later on. I can't remember any specific troop.
So, anything else about any other exercise?
Yes, this was on the same exercise, but it wasn't so drastic as this. Nothing very drastic about this one, but I was sent down to a town in Yorkshire called Ripon, and the River Ur. Yeah, the River Ur runs through this. And this was all to do with the ramps, similar the ramps from a tank landing craft. So what there was, there was about 3 to 4 foot of water in the river. They put concrete ramps in and out of the river. It was about a river about 20 yards across. So the tank went in one end through the river and out the other end, then across the bridge and done the circuit again. Now I was sent down there with two bodies on a recovery vehicle, on a Scammel recovery vehicle. We were down there for approximately a week. The tank was already down there. It had its trunking on the back. The trunking was for the engine trunking to stop the water from going into the engine. And we stayed there down there for 7 days. And drivers were coming in, drivers and co-drivers were coming in on a daily basis. And we, not manhandled, but it was just a question of what they had to do. And we were right at the end of the race course, and there was a NAFI on this race course. And the girls from the NAFI every day used to bring us a meal from the NAFI. They used to walk across from the NAFI. It's just something that stands out in my memory.
What was it? Did you do this landing exercise? Did you do it yourself?
I used to do it every day for the simple reason that the NAFI girl used to come over, and there was one or two. We were about a mile and a half, 2 miles from the town of Ripon, And we used to take the villagers used to come down, and we used to take them through when all the drivers had gone. And you had to these concrete ramps were obviously made special, and you had to be very, very careful going in. You couldn't rush up them because otherwise you would be water in the driving compartments. And we used to take these through the river, not on a nightly exercise, but whenever we had the time.
How deep was it?
About 3 to 4 feet.
And the waterproofing worked?
The only waterproofing that we had, we didn't have the normal. I mean, the engine plates underneath, they weren't waterproof. It was only the chutes that came out of the back of the engine compartment. So you weren't in there all that long. It was just a matter of going into the ramp, across the riverbed, and then out at the other side.
And
the waterproofing came at a later date.
Anything else about Exercise Eagle?
No, I can't think of anything else.
And another thing that was, they used to go, they went up to the ranges at Kirkwood Bright a couple of times, to practice shooting. Do you remember that at all? Not really.
No, I can't even remember firing at all. I just can't remember any firing at all.
The next thing then, anything else about your time at Rudston and Bridlington?
No, nothing more on the Rudston Bridlington side at all.
So
when we come back, we were. I didn't move with the squadron to Bridlington because I was down in Brigade Workshop. When I come back, I was taken back into Bridlington, which I knew, we knew a lot about it because for the simple reason that we Air Liberty wagons used to go there on a weekly basis. And in fact, one of the trucks going in on a Saturday night, one of the squadron trucks went in, and the truck turned over and there were three men killed on that particular.
How did you get on with the Yorkshire people in Rudston and Bridlington?
Ah, fine. I always felt that farther north you went, the people became much better. I think that today.
Even as a southerner?
Yeah, I've been up to Yorkshire. In fact, I've been back to Ripon. I've been down to the river, and the concrete ramps are still there. I also went to Rudston to the pub. Me and my wife, we stayed there overnight. But I just couldn't seem to get myself orientated. I can remember the church, the pub. I can remember where we were we were in Nissen Huts. And then we popped into Bridlington. The landlord, we'd seen the landlord. He said, look, he said, you, if you can't get put up at Bridlington, come back to us. We'll put you up for the night. We came back there, and we hadn't been in there all that long because he put us up for the night, shut us the room. We come down, and the pub was literally filled. And he said, here, we got a surprise for you. Well, he said, when I say a surprise, there's a lot of people that want to meet you. Although, he said, they're not of your age group, and they can't remember, except for one person that can remember the 5-4 for Yeomanry in Rudston. And she didn't happen to be there, but I saw her the following morning. I see this woman coming out of the newspaper shop, which was next to the pub. And I went up to her, and I said, almost introduced myself. I said, I don't know whether you can remember us at Rudston. In 1944, I think it was, 44, early 44. She said, yes, she said, I certainly do. I can remember you and all your tanks. That's all she said, but it did make it that. But going back to the night before, we had a splendid meal, and of course we went back.
Now, the next thing then is would be the visit when you went up to Aldershot, which I think was
Warburg Barracks.
Now, what do you remember of that? What were the barracks like?
The barracks were the barracks were
Were they old?
Oh, they remain. They were very, very old barracks, and some of them were not Nissen huts, but normally wooden huts. A lot of wooden huts there, which we happened to be in. I can't remember where the, in relation to the barracks, I can't remember where the cookhouse is one bit. And I do, and I also remember that we did have, when we used to mount guard, we had one chappie that had a bagpipe, and we used to mount guard with this bagpipe. That's all of the band we had, and I can always remember this. And since then, I have met him.
Was the bagpipe important? I mean, you were sort of...
No, not to me. No, it didn't mean a thing to me. Maybe it did to the Scots, but it certainly didn't mean anything to me. Although, nowadays, I do like to be behind. We do have, when we go on these trips around, we have bagpipes and whatever.
Now, one thing it says about in the thing is that crew commanders and other people visited, saw demonstrations of German tanks and equipment. Would that come down to you, or was that just a tank commander?
Well, we never saw. We really, yeah, we were kept informed what was happening. We all knew that D-Day was coming up. We didn't know a lot about what we were going to meet. We weren't frightened yet, but I can never remember meeting anything. I can't remember meeting, going to any information other than air general duty and such like guards. I think the worst thing that we were ever put on was when we were waterproofing a tank.
Did you do that at Aldershot?
We'd done this.
Can you tell me exactly how you did it? The Sherman in particular, you know, the actual tanks themselves, how did you go about waterproofing? What did you use?
All the engine plates, which I think amounted to about 12 of different sizes. Some of them took two men to lower. All the plates had to be lowered, and there was for each plate there was a gasket. The main thing was Bostik. Still taking Bostik out of my fingers now. This was we had weeks and weeks of this.
Can you just explain what Bostik was? I mean, now it's Bostik. Glue. Was it glue then? I mean,
it was a black. We were supplied with tubes and tubes of this. I wouldn't suggest it was a plastic. Maybe when we put it on, it hit and it hardened. So all the engine plates had to be dropped, gaskets, Bostik, and all the bolts. And you can imagine there were dozens and dozens of these bolts that had to be put back. Now this was one of the worst jobs on waterproofing. Then there was a conduit, ducting that went from the back doors of the engine compartment. On the rear end of the Sherman, there's two doors that open. The chute, whatever you like to call it, these were about 6 foot, 6-7 foot, just above the top of the turret, but at the back end. These were bolted on, gaskets, Bostik. It all involved gaskets and Bostik. Then the front of the tank, there was the air inlet. There was another one, different shape. And these two had to be fitted. The driver's compartment, the turret, had to be sealed, but they had to be left to the last minute, and I can't quite remember how they were sealed up. In the end, we didn't need them, but I can't remember how they were sealed up. The guns, then, they had to be sealed, and they had small charges in these that when we got to the other side, we could blow them, and we were ready for action within a matter of seconds. So both machine guns and the 75mm or whatever.
Now, did you work on this as a crew doing your tank?
You were only concerned with your tank, because each crew of the troop was involved in his own tank.
And how long would it take to do your tank?
I would think it probably took, the way we were going on, it probably took two or 3 weeks to complete this. And it was a nightmare, really. It was a nightmare. And then we had the 17-pounders coming in. Now, each troop of four had four 75mm guns. One was taken out, and the 17-pounder was brought in.
Now, these
came in over a period. There wasn't 64 tanks with 17-pounder guns came in. They just come in. Your troop has got the gun. In fact, I think some commanders got picked up their own 17-pounder. In fact, I think I'm right in saying that ours, with Steele Brownlee, because I was in his troop then, Troop 4, we've been detailed into troops. He went up north, I think, and picked his own up. By road.
So he drove all the way?
Drove all the way back to pick his, because he wouldn't have taken the 75 back up there, that would have stayed down wherever they used to put these cast off tanks that they weren't cast off, but they were no longer any good to us.
So, now, did you get a 17-pounder gun on your tank? Your particular tank?
No, we were 75.
You stayed on the 75mm.
It was always, because I was in the troop leader's tank, but it was always reckoned that the 17-pounder always came in line. If they came in line, they would be always the last of the troop. And this was generally brought forward for tank, if any tanks were.
Now,
and I think, I'm not sure about this, but I think I'm right in saying, I may be wrong, but I think I'm right in saying that the 17-pounder only had armour-piercing ammunition. I may be wrong.
Now, so, when the 17-pounder, was it a replacement gun or a replacement tank?
Replacement tank.
You got a whole new tank.
Oh, yes.
They had another name, didn't they? I mean,
Firefly.
So, Sherman Firefly, or were they just the Firefly?
Firefly. We called them 17-pounder, but it was always a Firefly, and we would explain it was a 17-pounder. So when it came to us, it was a tank with a Firefly, with a 17-pounder in it.
And did you want to, I mean, were you envious of the tank, of the crews that had those tanks, or were you happy enough with?
When I had one, I thought to myself, oh gracious, this is something different.
I bet you got that later. We'll come to how much better it or worse it was. Well,
yeah.
Better from the sound of it.
Yes and no.
Yeah, we'll have a look at what was the thing. Now, so the 17. Now, you mentioned you'd got a troop. Now, what you said, and you were in which troop?
I was in 4 troop, and the commander, if you wish to have the name, the commander was Steele Brownlee.
Now,
he was a lieutenant.
What was your Steele Brownlee? See, we know of him. I know he's dead now, but we know of him because we have a copy of his memoirs.
Yeah.
What was your opinion, and if you could tell us anything about him, sort of while you knew him at Aldershot and the rest of it, what kind of a man was he, and how did he come across to you as a troop leader and as a chap at that time?
I'm not going to suggest that I liked him, but I will say that he was a good commander, or generally all round. Especially when we went over the other side. I thought he was always with the troop over in England. Not so when he got over the other side. I think he was a good, and I think he was a fair troop commander.
What made him good? I mean, what was it about him? What did you look for, to look at it another way, what did you look for in a troop commander? What did you want him to do that made him good?
Well, I wanted him to be able to look after us. I would also suggest that he was a brave, forward-looking if there was anything that he could get for us, he would. He would. I would suggest that he was a bit of a scrounger and a good one, a good scrounger.
Now, you said, and I don't want to be too negative about it, but you said you weren't going to pretend to like him. What was his character like for you? What was it that you saw about him that perhaps you didn't always like?
I think he was quite brash. I think, and I know later, that he preferred to have an all-Scottish crew. But that didn't mean that he didn't have a lot to do. I'm not suggesting that he objected to me being in the crew. That's all I can say.
Now, were you actually in his crew?
Yes.
Or in his tank, rather?
Well, I was in his crew tank.
Yeah, and so you were in the command tank of four troop. So there's still Brownlee.
Still Brownlee was a lieutenant. Gunner, which is I said his name, Buck Buchanan.
And what was he like?
A very, very good gunner. Very, very quick. He could see things, maybe, that he could see things that is quick as what Brownlee could. He would get his gun onto it if he could see. He's always on the lookout. He was a good gunner. Very good.
Obviously Scottish.
Oh yes, he was Scottish. I was the only English one there, but he was exceptional.
What about the wireless operator?
That would be Ingram.
And what was he like?
Yes, he was very, very good, because a wireless operator was a wireless operator and loader. He was the loader of the gun, and he was very, very quick. He could put a 75mm shell, and they're quite on the long side, so they're about 2 foot, 2 foot six long. He would have one in the breech, and he'd have one on his leg, and be able to pick that up and load this within seconds.
So that's the wireless operator, Ingram,
and the driver. Was McKinnon.
And what was he like?
He's a good driver. I've got to say this: the whole of the crew, I'm not including myself, but the crew was good. Was a very good all. They complemented each other. Now, I believe that this was all due to Brownlee. You know, maybe I didn't like Steel Brownlee all that lot, but I must admit that I think the crew, you got the crew to complement each other.